Hey everybody, welcome to our second Something Genuine program. We had a big turnout last week. I think Shauna, I probably should have had you announce this again this morning in the service. Anyway, we'll see how participation goes. I'm loving it, so I hope you guys are. In fact, tonight we are going to do a TED Talk that was recommended by Shauna. It's called How to Tame Your Wandering Mind by Amishi Jha, or something like that. That's my pronunciation of the woman's name. So, I think we have our technical issues worked out, but it will take me a minute, I think, to get the screen to be the right size. So bear with me as I make this change over. Let's see.
Consider the following statement. Human beings only use 10% of their brain capacity. Well, as a neuroscientist, I can tell you that while Morgan Freeman delivered this line with the gravitas that makes him a great actor, this statement is entirely false. The truth is, human beings use 100% of their brain capacity. The brain is a highly efficient, energy-demanding organ that gets fully utilized. And even though it is at full capacity being used, it suffers from a problem of information overload. There's far too much in the environment than it can fully process. So to solve this problem of overload, evolution devised a solution, which is the brain's attention system. Attention allows us to notice, select, and direct the brain's computational resources to a subset of all that's available. We can think of attention as the leader of the brain. Wherever attention goes, the rest of the brain follows. In some sense, it's your brain's boss. And over the last 15 years, I've been studying the human brain's attention system. In all of our studies, I've been very interested in one question. If it is indeed the case that our attention is the brain's boss, is it a good boss? Does it actually guide us well? And to dig in on this big question, I wanted to know three things. First, how does attention control our perception? Second, why does it fail us, often leaving us feeling foggy and distracted? And third, can we do anything about this fogginess? Can we train our brain to pay better attention, to have more strong and stable attention in the work that we do in our lives? So, I wanted to give you a brief glimpse into how we're going to look at this, a very poignant example of how our attention ends up getting utilized. And I want to do it using the example of somebody that I know quite well. He ends up being part of a very large group of people that we work with for whom attention is a matter of life and death. Think of medical professionals or firefighters or soldiers or Marines. This is the story of a Marine captain, Captain Jeff Davis. And the scene that I'm going to share with you, as you can see, is not about his time in the battlefield. He was actually on a bridge in Florida. But instead of looking at the scenery around him, seeing the beautiful vistas and noticing the cool ocean breezes, he was driving fast and contemplating driving off that bridge. And he would later tell me that it took all of everything he had not to do so. You see, he just returned from Iraq. And while his body was on that bridge, his mind, his attention, was thousands of miles away. He was gripped with suffering. His mind was worried and preoccupied and had stressful memories and really dread for his future. And I'm really glad that he didn't take his life. Because he, as a leader, knew that he wasn't the only one that was probably suffering. Many of his fellow Marines probably were too. With me, in the first of its kind project that actually allowed us to test and offer something called mindfulness training to active duty military personnel. But before I tell you about what mindfulness training is or the results of that study, I think it's important to understand how attention works in the brain. So what we do in the laboratory is that many of our studies of attention involve brainwave recordings. In these brainwave recordings, people were funny looking caps that are sort of like swimming caps that have electrodes embedded in them. These electrodes pick up the ongoing brain electrical activity, and they do it with millisecond temporal precision. So we can see these small yet detectable voltage fluctuations over time. And doing this, we can very precisely plot the timing of the brain's activity. About 170 milliseconds after we show our research participants a face on the screen, we see a very reliable, detectable brain signature. It happens right at the back of the scalp, above the regions of the brain that are involved in face processing. Now, this happens so reliably and so on cue as the brain's face detector that we've even given this brainwave component a name. We call it the N170 component. And we use this component in many of our studies. It allows us to see the impact that attention may have on our perception. So I want to give you a sense of the kind of experiments that we actually do in the lab. We would show participants images like this one. You should see a face and a scene overlaid on each other. And what we do is we ask our participants, as they're viewing a series of these types of overlaid images, to do something with their attention. On some trials, we'll ask them to pay attention to the face. And to make sure they're doing that, we ask them to tell us by pressing a button if the face appeared to be male or female. On other trials, we ask them to tell us what the scene was. Was it indoor or outdoor? And in this way, we can manipulate attention and confirm that the participants were actually doing what we said. Our hypotheses about attention were as follows. If attention is indeed doing its job and affecting perception, maybe it works like an amplifier. And what I mean by this is that when we direct attention to the face, it becomes clearer and more salient, right? It's easier to see. But when we direct it to the scene, the face becomes barely perceptible as we process the scene information. So what we wanted to do is look at this brainwave component of face detection, the N170, and see if it changed at all as a function of where our participants were paying attention to the scene or the face. And here's what we found. We found that when they paid attention to the face, the N170 was larger. And when they paid attention to the scene, as you can see in red, it was smaller. And that gap you see between the blue and red lines is pretty powerful. What it tells us is that attention, which is really the only thing that changed since the images they viewed were identical in both cases, attention changes perception. And it does so very fast, within 170 milliseconds of actually seeing a face. In our follow-up studies, we wanted to look to see what would happen. How could we perturb or diminish this effect? And our hunch was that if you give people or put people in a very stressful environment, if you distract them with disturbing negative images, images of suffering and violence, sort of like what you might see on the news, unfortunately, that doing this might actually affect their attention. And that's indeed what we found. If we present stressful images while they're doing this experiment, this gap of attention shrinks, its power diminishes. So in some of our other studies, we wanted to see, okay, great. Not great, actually bad news that stress does this to the brain, but if it is the case that stress has this powerful influence on attention through external distraction, what if we don't need external distraction? What if we distract ourselves? And to do this, we had to basically come up with an experiment in which we could have people generate their own mind wandering. This is having off-task thoughts while we're engaged in an ongoing task of some sort. And the trick to mind wandering is that essentially you bore people. So hopefully there's not a lot of mind wandering happening right now. When we bore people, people happily generate all kinds of internal content to occupy themselves, right? So we devised what might be considered one of the world's most boring experiments. All the participants saw were a series of faces on the screen, one after another. They pressed the button every time they saw the face. That was pretty much it. Well, the one trick was that sometimes the face would be upside down, and it would happen very infrequently. On those trials, they were told just to withhold the response. Pretty soon, we could tell that they were successfully mind-wandering because they pressed the button when that face was upside down, even though it's quite plain to see that it was upside down. So we wanted to know here, what happens when people have mind-wandering? And what we found was that, very similar to external stress and external distraction in the environment, internal distraction, our own mind-wandering, also shrinks the gap of attention. It diminishes attention's power. So what do all of these studies tell us? They tell us that attention is very powerful in terms of affecting our perception. Even though it's so powerful, it's also fragile and vulnerable. And things like stress and mind wandering diminish its power. But that's all in the context of these very controlled laboratory settings. What about in the real world? What about in our actual day-to-day life? What about now? Where is your attention right now? To kind of bring it back, I'd like to make a prediction about your attention for the remainder of my talk. You're up for it? Here's the prediction. You will be unaware of what I'm saying for 4 out of the next 8 minutes. It's a challenge, so pay attention, please. Now, why am I saying this? I'm surely going to assume that you're going to remain seated and, you know, graciously keep your eyes on me as I speak. But a growing body of literature suggests that we mind wander. We take our mind away from the task at hand about 50% of our waking moments. These might be small little trips that we take away, private thoughts that we have. And when this mind wandering happens, it can be problematic. Now, I don't think there'll be any dire consequences with you all sitting here today, but imagine a military leader missing 4 minutes of a military briefing, or a judge missing 4 minutes of testimony, or a surgeon or firefighter missing any time. The consequences in those cases could be dire. So one question we might ask is, why do we do this? Why do we mind wander so much? Well, part of the answer is that our mind is an exquisite time-traveling master. It can actually time travel very easily. If we think of the mind sort of with the metaphor of a music player, we see this. We can rewind the mind to the past to reflect on events that have already happened, right? Or we can go in fast future to plan for the next thing that we want to do. And we land in this mental time travel mode or the path of the past or the future very frequently. And we land there often without our awareness, most times without our awareness, even if we want to be paying attention. Think of just the last time we were trying to read a book, got to the bottom of the page with no idea what the words were saying, right? This happens to us. And when this happens, when we mind wander without an awareness that we're doing it, there are consequences. We make errors. We miss critical information sometimes, and we have difficulty making decisions. What's worse is when we experience stress, when we're in a moment of overwhelm, we don't just reflect on the past when we rewind. We end up being in the past ruminating, reliving, or regretting events that have already happened. Or under stress, we fast forward the mind, not just to productively plan, but we end up catastrophizing or worrying about events that haven't happened yet and frankly may never happen. So at this point, you might be thinking to yourself, okay, mind wandering is happening a lot. Often it happens without our awareness. And under stress, it's even worse. We mind wander more powerfully and more often. Is there anything we can possibly do about this? And I'm happy to say the answer is yes. From our work, we're learning that the opposite of a stressed and wandering mind is a mindful one. Mindfulness has to do with paying attention to our present moment experience with awareness and without any kind of emotional reactivity of what's happening. It's about keeping that button right on play to experience the moment-to-moment unfolding of our lives. And mindfulness is not just a concept. It's more like practice. You have to embody this mindful mode of being to have any benefits. And a lot of the work that we're doing, we're offering people programs that give our participants a suite of exercises that they should do daily in order to cultivate more moments of mindfulness in their life. And for many of the groups that we work with, high stress groups, like I said, soldiers, medical professionals, for them, we know that mind wandering can be really dire. So we want to make sure we offer them very accessible, low time constraints to optimize the training so they can benefit from it. And when we do this, what we can do is track to see what happens, not just in their regular lives, but when we offer it in the most demanding circumstances that they may have. Why do we want to do this? Well, we want to, for example, give it to students right around final season. Or we want to give the training to accountants during tax season, or soldiers and Marines while they're deploying. Why is that? Because those are the moments that in which their attention is most likely to be vulnerable because of stress and mind wandering. And those are also the moments in which we want their attention to be in peak shape so they can perform well. So what we do in our research is we have them take a series of attention tests. We track their attention at the beginning of some kind of high-stress interval. And then 2 months later, we track them again, and we want to see if there's a difference. Is there any benefit of offering them mindfulness training? Can we protect against the lapses in attention that might arise over high stress? So here's what we find. Over a high-stress interval, unfortunately, the reality is if we don't do anything at all, attention declines. People are worse at the end of this high-stress interval than before. But if we offer mindfulness training, we can protect against this. They stay stable, even though, just like the other groups, they were experiencing high stress. And perhaps even more impressive is that if people take our training programs over, let's say, 8 weeks, and they fully commit to doing the daily mindfulness exercises that allow them to learn how to be in the present moment, well, they actually get better over time, even though they're in high stress. And this last point is actually important to realize, because what it suggests to us is that mindfulness exercises are very much like physical exercise. If you don't do it, you don't benefit. But if you do engage in mindfulness practice, the more you do, the more you benefit. And I want to just bring it back to Captain Jeff Davis. As I mentioned to you at the beginning, his Marines were involved in the very first project that we ever did of offering mindfulness training. And they showed this exact pattern, which was very heartening. We had offered them the mindfulness training right before they were deployed to Iraq. And upon their return, Captain Davis shared with us what he was feeling was the benefit of this program. He said that, unlike last time, after this deployment, they were much more present. They were discerning. They were not as reactive. And in some cases, they were really more compassionate with the people they were engaging with and each other. He said in many ways, he felt that the mindfulness training program we offered gave them a really important tool to protect against developing post-traumatic stress disorder, and even allowing it to turn into post-traumatic growth. To us, this was very compelling. And it ended up that Captain Davis and I, you know, this was about a decade ago in 2008. We've kept in touch all these years. And he himself has gone on to continue practicing mindfulness in a daily way. He was promoted to major. He actually then ended up retiring from the Marine Corps. He went on to get a divorce, to get remarried, to have a child, to get an MBA. And through all of these challenges and transitions and joys of his life, he kept up with his mindfulness practice. And as fate would have it, just a few months ago, Captain Davis suffered a massive heart attack at the age of 46. And he ended up calling me a few weeks ago. And he said, "I want to tell you something. I know that the doctors who worked on me, they saved my heart, but mindfulness saved my life. The presence of mind I had to stop the ambulance that ended up taking me to the hospital himself. The clarity of mind he had to notice when there was fear and anxiety happening, but not be gripped by it. He said, for me, these were the gifts of mindfulness. And I was so relieved to hear that he was okay, but really heartened to see that he had transformed his own attention. He went from having a really bad boss, an attention system that nearly drove him off a bridge, to one that was an exquisite leader and guide and saved his life. So I want to actually end by sharing my call to action to all of you. And here it is. Pay attention to your attention. All right? Pay attention to your attention and incorporate mindfulness training as part of your daily wellness toolkit, in order to tame your own wandering mind and to allow your attention to be a trusted guide in your own life. Thank you.
Okay. I want to open it up to, I loved the video. Shauna was concerned it might be a little dry when she originally recommended it, but I love the video because it's just science saying, yeah, what Regina said, that's right. I loved the parting comment. Her call to action was to pay attention to your attention. What does that sound like, right? It sounds an awful lot like awareness watching awareness to me. I also love the video because we're currently looking at this book on mindfulness from, well, this one, from Locke Kelly. I've been looking at this on Wednesdays. And lots of reasons, and I could go on and on, but I won't. I really do want to invite you guys to tell me what you thought of the video. And if you didn't like it, if you thought it was dry, tell me that, because, you know, your opinion shapes what we do next week. So happy to hear from you. Anybody? Shauna?
I just thought it was great too. It's really nice to get the confirmation that what we do, what our practice is, really works. And that some of the statistics, like our mind wanders 50% of the time. Oh my gosh. And that we would hear 4 minutes of her 8 minutes. I mean, it's like, whoa, that alone is worth paying attention to. And what she said about the past and the future, that's also what we teach, that we ruminate about the past and we worry about the future and we want to, you know, not do that. And paying attention to the present moment with awareness, it's just exactly what our teachings are. And embody this, embody the mode of, you know, mindfulness training. For it to work, we have to practice it. And as we practice it, it can get better. That's just such good news. And especially, she said, the practice made the soldiers more discerning, more compassionate, and more clear-minded. And that's on the battlefield. I mean, that's awesome. Just amazing. And she said they had post-traumatic growth instead of post-traumatic stress. And the clarity of mind to notice the fear but not be gripped by it. That's exactly what we try to do. That's exactly it. So pay attention to your attention. I just really like this. And thank you for choosing that, Jacqueline.
Thank you, Shauna. Yeah, if the soldiers can do it on the battlefield, hey, how hard is it when you're sitting in your living room chair, right? Yeah, good points, Shauna. You pulled them out well. Thank you for sharing them. Lulu, did you want to share?
I think Sharon wants to share.
Oh, I'm sorry, Miss Sharon. I saw Lulu a while ago. Yeah. Go, okay. Sharon, you're unmuted, go. And then we'll get to you.
I loved it. I mean, it's the thing that's helped me the most is awareness, watching awareness. And when Regina said to us in Gentle Healing One a couple of years ago, you're casters of attention, that was like bingo for me. I got to, you know, more my training, mindfulness, and to remain... Because one of the things as Sharon is all through my life is teachers would write, she doesn't pay attention because I was daydreaming. So for me to know, and awareness, watching awareness puts you in the present completely if you just sit there. That's what it's there for. So the other things can fall away. So I loved last week. I love this week. I love what you're doing.
Good. Thank you, Sharon. And let me comment on your teacher say she needs to pay attention or she doesn't pay attention. When I remember very early in my college career, one of my first classes, I suddenly realized the teacher was saying something. I went, oh my God. I could not keep my mind on what was being said. And I knew that I was going to be tested on this stuff. And it was, I just remember it being such an obvious struggle to try and pay attention. So I can relate to that. She doesn't pay attention.
And I had that all through my life in school. I mean, it was just something, you know, they would label it today ADHD probably, right?
Yeah, I think they would, but you notice she said the studies are showing that it's common to everybody, which is probably why they're overdiagnosing ADHD. that most people don't pay attention 50% of the time. Yeah.
Yeah. And last week actually gave me a lot of new insight about what's going on and how, you know, I was kind of like walking and realizing that it's all coming through me. You know, it's all my mind. And, you know, even though I knew that intellectually, it seems to go deeper now because I'm practicing more and just, you know, So I was really looking forward to your program, Jacqueline.
Good. Thank you, Sharon.
Thank you.
Awesome. Now, Lulu, did you want to share?
Yeah, sure. Hi, Jacqueline. Hi, everybody.
Oh, I'm not hearing you.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Hi, thanks. Good pick. Yeah, you know, the song came to mind, the YMCA. YMCA for awareness. I don't know where that came from, but awareness. Woo! Yeah, great choice. No, she said the word boss, I think, twice. Really liked how she said, you know, the rewind or the fast forward. She talked about, you know, the play being the present moment. That's what I heard. And, you know, as she was talking about her programs, like, you know, like the mindfulness techniques that I guess they offer, I was like, this week, what's been so helpful to me is this thought about I do not want. It has been so helpful to me. And then I choose, you know, truth, peace, because the, you know, whatever, just the thoughts are coming up, and then I'm remembering to just be like, this thought about I do not want, I choose, and then I fill in the blank. That has really helped. Like, I feel like we have like techniques that are working. Like, I don't feel like we had to buy it. Like, I don't, we can see what they're doing. Like, you're probably looking into possibly what they're doing, but I feel like the ones that are offered in AT are working, are starting to really work for me. And just that, and walking has been really helping me kind of change the, okay, realizing like, okay, this is not who I am. And I want to be in play. I want to be in presence, in awareness. So thanks for letting me share.
Thanks, Lulu. Yeah, of course, Lulu is referring to review lessons instructions that we're using this week in Gentle Healing. And it's something that we've been talking about for a long time. In fact, all of this is, we started Gentle Healing with talking about rewiring the brain and becoming casters, learning that we actually are casters of attention and using that to our advantage. And so this I do not want is to turn away from what I do not want, what seems to be coming up of its own accord, and then turning our attention to focus on the truth of what we are, awareness, life, presence. And I think you're right. I think we have been given the tools to do exactly what she's talking about. And it certainly doesn't hurt. And, you know, the stuff we're looking at with Locke Kelly about these, he calls them mindful glimpses. Bentinho Massaro talks about the 2 to 5 seconds, just taking, you know, just that amount of time to do this. And this is the training, I think, I mean, I don't know what training woman who spoke is offering, but what she did say, what we need to be clear on is that it's the practice. You know, to do it once in a while and go, oh, well, that didn't work, or yeah, it was good while it lasted. That's not really helpful. It's to become a way of being. It helps us. You know, I think that those spans get longer and longer without conscious effort. Once we drop in on a regular basis, and I think that's what she's the speaker was recommending. Yeah. So thanks, Lulu. Regina.
Yeah, well, first of all, I'm tired, and I knew that coming into this, and so I didn't know what the TED Talk was going to be about, but I knew that I was tired and that I wouldn't pay attention unless I took notes. So it's funny, I was taking notes in order to train myself to pay attention. I thought it was funny that ended up being what the talk was about. But one of the things that I found really interesting is when she was talking about the soldier, and she mentioned that as he was driving across the bridge, he wasn't paying attention to the, for example, the sea breeze, et cetera. His mind was thousands of miles away in the past, thinking about the war that had just left, and he considered driving himself off the bridge. And she also talked about how, in fact, since I was taking notes, let me find my she also talked about how with attention, what we do is we notice and we select a subset because there's just too much going on to pay attention to in any moment. That she said we're using 100% of our brain power, and even with that, it's low. The brain cannot pay attention to everything. So now I'm squishing those two things together. So it's kind of interesting to note that we can't pay attention to everything. Like if you just sit and look at the room that you're in right now, you know, I mean, I have a telephone next to me on one side, a book next to me on another side. I have cords coming in my computer. I have a lot of paperwork laying here. I have water, you know, Ron's over there with his water and his computer and his papers. Oh, and there's blankets and there's pictures on the walls and there's leaves on the tree. The leaves are different colors. And, you know, I could go on and on and on. We can't pay attention to it all. So what is naturally happening is that the attention is selecting what's most important. But what's interesting is that attention can be very, very distorted. You know, like driving across a bridge, you know, with, you know, beautiful beach nearby, a sea nearby, beautiful breeze, maybe some seagulls, and the mind has selected as most important the war that I just left to pay attention to. So it seems like a part of this training is, well, it comes back to, you know, what I learned through NTI. It's what do I truly want? Because attention is a value-based decision. If I can't pay attention to everything, what do I truly want to pay attention to right now? You know, do I want to pay attention to these thoughts of the past or these thoughts of the future? Do I want to pay attention to this experience that's right in front of me? Do I want to pay attention to my work? Do I want to pay attention to how my body's feeling? I can't pay attention to it all. And so I think it's okay that we accept that. You know, we don't want to feel guilty because I'm not paying attention to what's happening over there, because I can't pay attention to what's happening over there and in here and out there. You know, I can't. But realizing that it's a value decision and getting much, much better at finding out I really want attention now and pay attention to everything. And that's training attention, I think, is to go with my truest values. And that's it. Thank you.
Lovely. Thank you. Dawn.
Based on some recent insights, I would have to disagree with some of the things she said and other things I really resonated with. When she discussed that our mind is like a time travel machine, how we can rewind and fast forward, I believe that's just layering another illusion on top of illusion. What I'm learning from the way the brain works is this is imagination. We're not time travelers. We're not really going back in time.
Yeah, you don't think she really meant that, do you?
and them to get some kind of, oh yeah, I'm time traveling. This is like a real thing happening. Well, what we're learning through, like what Regina's talking about, learning what to value and put our attention or believing attention towards, is what it and what Byron Katie teaches is to learn ultimately what is fantasy, aka imagination, and then what is reality. Like reality for me right now is sitting here on chair, listening to rain, looking at your faces, computer. That's it. That's reality. Now, imagination is me going back in the past and thinking about all the stuff that may have happened. And a future, yeah, I can make plans. And that's a great use of the mind. But like she said, what I did resonate with is how when we catastrophize and we agonize and this and going back and regretting and just staying stuck and mulling over things until we're just, it's not solving anything. And we're actually using our neural network. And this takes energy. This takes life force energy to do all these things. And it's like spinning your wheels in like energetic mud. You're not going anywhere. But if you were to make a plan and you can use your energy efficiently, I can see where the mindfulness is really helful. The thing that I almost want to laugh hysterically at is, hell, and no one's laughing, but I'm laughing, is they're making the warriors compassionate? Like, okay, if enough people get compassionate enough, what's going to happen to war? What's going to happen to the military? Now, I've heard, and there was a controversy over this with a mindfulness movement and something called the mindful sniper. So where someone's so focused, they're just like on it, and then a boom, 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 and they can, you know, take out a bunch of people because they're so mindful. Now, what I heard from her report of this guy, which strangely enough, it didn't seem to affect his heart in a positive way because he had a heart attack at 46. That's pretty young. That's only a couple years older than me. That's like, oh. And so you'd think there'd be some health benefits. But one of the things that I don't want to dismiss is like the fact if this is building compassion in people, that is a wonderful thing. But I don't know how it's going to make for a great army. I mean, great that you're not going to shoot your fellow, you know, because that sometimes happens too. You know, you mix who's the enemy and who's, you know, you shoot your own man, you know, if you have compassion, it would be helpful. I don't know. I see this as hilarious. Maybe this is the way to stop war. I don't know.
Don, you're so funny. First of all, let me say though, actually when she did that, rewind, future forward. And I actually thought of you because of what you had been saying, on a rewatching of it, what you'd been saying about, imagination and what we got from the Byron Katie, video on the work, you know, you're not there. She talked to a guy in the audience who said he's mad when, because his, we don't know if it's his roommate or whatever, someone he knows won't pay the bills. And she's like, so think of a time, can you see her not paying the bills? And he's like, well, she doesn't exist. She's like, exactly. Now you know the difference between illusion and reality. So, and that's what may have started, certainly added to Dawn's contemplation of this issue. But I think when she said you were we were being time travelers, I think she was saying the same thing. I think she's going, you know, nobody really thinks you're time traveling. And I think her focus was more on the, and congratulations for your stellar pronunciation of the word catastrophizing. I'd like to say that word, but I'm not sure I can. So it's rumination and regret and all that in the past. I mean, that's all you're ever going to do in the past anyway, right? Or worry and catastrophizing in the future. I mean, you know, you can see that is simply mind wandering. What a waste of time that is. So I think you and she are probably on the same page as that. I liked her thing about the soldiers becoming more compassionate, and that's all that I'm going to say on that subject. I think Glenn might have some things to say on that subject because I could see he was in total agreement with what Don was saying. Would you like to share it, Glenn?
I really like. She was really pointing out that the truth is true. You know, that you place your attention on what you place your attention on is what you're really going to get more of. Now, if you can place your attention on every awful thing that's ever happened to you and be that person in the world, you know, like we were talking about the lesson today, be that, you know, my identity is I'm broken, you know, and that's how you present and that's what you teach. So, and when something is true, even if it's a spiritual idea or a spiritual truth, it can be used in many, many different ways. Like Dawn was saying, you could become a really, really, you know, excellent sniper. You know, you could be a really talented assassin, you know, or a wonderful manipulator or an incredible propagandist. Or, you know, you could teach yourself to lie and not be able to be detected, you know, to pass lie detector tests and things like that. So these concepts are always true. But I like it how, because if she linked attention with compassion, because I think that's where the real deepness of it is. I don't think you can really have excellent attention, I think concentration or focus, maybe but that concentration and focusing on what you want and what you, you know, where you do it is our ability to find out where it is that is ours to do, who we are in the world, that kind of regular kind of placing my attention on what I want to see in the world, placing my attention on who I want to be in the world, placing my attention on the what, how I act and the world's reaction to it, then taking responsibility and being, and the only way to do that, and I totally agree with her, is to be present for it. The constant I call them red flags in my own practice, is just put a red flag in the in your own mind where you know what your favorite subjects that, you know, I call them squirrels. It's like my favorite, like, distraction, my favorite thing. I just, you know, I'm just like, reel me. You say these things, do this thing. Is it just like, reel me in, you know? And learning something difficult. I was talking about learning Excel, like learning something difficult. I have to really remind myself again and again to come back to what I'm doing, I do that in meditation very easily with my own wandering, but I don't tend to often do it to use that skill in my own best interest to learn something that I find difficult, you know? So I can use this idea of concentrated awareness of my place in the world and learn how to act from it. But finding out, being present to who I am changes my focus. Right. And that's where the deepness is for me, because that the concentration is on the surface. The being a good sniper or being accomplishing an Excel spreadsheet is like on the surface of this awareness thing she's talking about. The unimaginable depth, I think, that it's available to us is as awareness looking at awareness, is where we can learn where that focus is, that hot spot, that magnifying glass of our brain where it actually starts the fire and gets something moving. And where is this well of energy? If you have enough energy, all these books say, you have enough to do what is yours to do in the world, then where is that well coming up? Where is that sprig? Where is the energy? Using that focus to tap into our inner strength, our inner knowledge, our inner self-knowledge, you know? To me, it's, and I'm so glad, and the other part I want to do, because I don't have to pay attention to everything in the world, and I don't have to know everything that's going on in the world, because I'm not the only one doing it. I have to focus on what mine's to do. I have to rely on you to focus on what yours is to do. And together we're the mind of God, right? So I don't have to be worried about or beat myself up for not knowing everything and not being able to be good at everything, because you're good at what I'm not good at.
Yeah.
And I rely on that. I need engineers. I need mothers. I need compassionate people. I need people that are smarter than me and know more than me, you know? I've got to have other people focusing on what is valuable to them. I cannot be policing focus in the world and like saying what is worth focusing on, what is not worth focusing on, other than to say, if you will focus on or learn to become present and aware of the deep strength within you and learn how to, you know, wrestle your squirrels to this moment, I think that's where all the fun is, right?
Right.
Yeah. And it's play. You hit play. Play is in the middle. Thanks.
Amen. That was beautiful, Glenn. Lovely, lovely, lovely. Perfectly said. Thank you for sharing it. Play is in the middle. All of it was perfect. And I really appreciate your participation. Yay. And the squirrel part, and Dawn just said she loves that you wrestle your squirrels. It's so fun, and I assume that's from that movie Up. I love that, you know, squirrel. So I don't know about the rest of the movie, but that is now part of our nomenclature, and I love it. I do the same thing, squirrel. Yeah. So thank you for sharing that. Does anybody else want to share? We would love to hear from you. And if so, we'll hear from you. If not, I have a little 6-minute follow-up. Would you guys like to see that? Okay. Before I play the follow, and it's not from the same woman, it's just a complimentary subject, and it's like 6 minutes. The guy is hard to understand, but hopefully the subtitles downloaded when I downloaded this. So let's see. So here goes. And again, bear with me while I get things in order. Let me pull him up. And this is called What Happens in Your Brain When You Pay Attention. So let me first get that pulled up, and then I'll play it for you.
Paying close attention to something, not that easy, is it? It's because our attention is pulled in so many different directions at a time, and it's in fact pretty impressive if you can stay focused. Many people think that attention is all about what we are focusing on, but it's also about what information our brain is trying to filter them out. There are two ways you direct your attention. First, there's over-attention. In over-attention, you move your eyes towards something in order to pay attention to it. Then there's covert-attention. In covert-attention, you pay attention to something, but without moving your eyes. Think of driving for a second. Your over-attention, your direction of the eyes, are in front. But that's your covert attention, which is constantly scanning the surrounding area where you don't actually look at them. I'm a computational neuroscientist, and I work on cognitive brain-machine interfaces, or bringing together the brain and the computer. I love brain patterns. Brain patterns are important for us because based on them, we can build models for the computers, and based on these models, computers can recognize how well our brain function, and if it doesn't function well, then these computers themselves can be used as assistive devices for therapies. But that also means something, because choosing the wrong patterns will give us the wrong models and therefore the wrong therapies, right? In case of attention, the fact that we can shift our attention not only by our eyes, but also by thinking, that makes covert attention an interesting model for computers. So I wanted to know, what is the brainwave patterns make you look overtly or when you look covertly? I set up an experiment for that. In this experiment, there are two flickering squares, one of them flickering slower rate than the other one. Depending on which of these flickers you are paying attention to, certain parts of your brain will start resonating in the same rate as that flickering rate. So by analyzing your brain signals, we can track where exactly you're watching or you're paying attention to. So to see what happens in your brain when you pay over attention, I ask people to look directly in one of the squares and pay attention to it. In this case, not surprisingly, we saw that these flickering squares appeared in their brain signals, which was coming from their back of their head, which is responsible for the processing of your visual information. But what I was really interested to see what happens in your brain when you pay covert attention. So this time I asked people to look in the middle of the screen and without moving their eyes, to pay attention to either of these squares. When we did that, we saw that both of these flickering rates appeared in their brain signals. But interestingly, only one of them, which was paid attention to, had stronger signals. So there was something in the brain which was handling these information. So that thing in the brain was basically the activation of the frontal area. The front part of your brain is responsible for higher cognitive functions as a human. The frontal part, it seems that it works as a filter, trying to let information coming only from the right flicker that you're paying attention to and trying to inhibit the information coming from the ignored one. The filtering ability of the brain is indeed a key for attention, which is missing in some people, for example, in people with ADHDs. So a person with ADHD cannot inhibit these distractors, and that's why they can't focus for a long time on a single task. But what if this person could play a specific computer game with his brain connected to the computer and then train his own brain to inhibit these distractors? Well, ADHD is just one example. We can use this cognitive brain machine interfaces for many other cognitive fields. It was just a few years ago that my grandfather had a stroke and he lost complete ability to speak. He could understand everybody, but there was no way to respond, even not writing, because he was illiterate. So he passed away in silence. I remember thinking at that time, what if we could have a computer which could speak for him? Now, after years that I'm in this field, I can see that this might be possible. Imagine if we can find brainwave patterns when people think about images or even letters. Like letter A generates a different brainwave pattern than letter B and so on. Could a computer one day communicate for people who can't speak? What if a computer can help us understand the thoughts of a person in a coma? Well, we are not there yet, but pay close attention. We will be there soon. Thank you.
That was not good, Don?
No, what he said. Well, what about your thinking in numbers on your bank account? Somebody read your mind. Now I know all your banking information.
Well, let me tell you what I liked about the video and why I chose it as a follow-up was that he said once you're trained on that slow blinking square for a while, even then when you turn back to this task, your brain resonated at this slow blinking state, so that again for me it was reinforcement that you can train your brain to calm down to be in this space, not in this one, right? So anyway, I thought it was kind of cool. So we are out of time. I really appreciate your all's participation. I think it's a fun project. I'm glad that you do. Send me, if you see any TED Talks you like, send them to me at jacqueline.awakeningtogether@yahoo.com. Maybe I'll type that in. Thanks a lot. It was fun. And I'll see you next week, same time.